of the dithyram. I first tried my skill on the first act, and devoted myself to it with a zeal which, for the first time, enabled me to taste the charm of enthusiasm in composition. One evening, just as I was going to enter the opera house, I felt myself so overmastered and tormented by my ideas that I put my money back into my pocket, ran home, and shut myself in. I went to bed, having first drawn the curtains close to prevent the daylight entering, and there, entirely abandoning myself to the poetical and musical inspiration, in 7 or 8 hours I rapidly composed the greater part of the act. I may say that my love for the Princess of Ferrara, for I was Tasso for the moment, and my noble and haughty feelings in the presence of her unjust brother, made me pass a night 100 times more delightful than if I'd spent it in the arms of the princess herself. In the morning, only a very small portion of what I'd composed remained in my head, but this little, almost obliterated by weariness and sleep, nevertheless bore evidence of the vigour of the whole, of which it only represented the remains. This time I did not carry on my work to any great extent, as I was diverted from it by other matters. While I was attached to the house of Dupin, Madame de Besenval and Madame de Broglie, whom I still saw occasionally, had not forgotten me. The Comte de Montagu, a captain in the Guards, had just been appointed ambassador at Venice. He owed his ambassadorship to Barjac, to whom he assiduously paid court. His brother, the Chevalier de Montagu, Gentilhomme de la Manche, to the Dauphin, was acquainted with these two ladies, and with the Abbé Allary of the French Academy, whom I also saw sometimes. Gentilhomme de la Manche was the name given to noblemen who attended on the French princes until they had finished their education. Madame de Broglie, knowing that the ambassador was looking out for a secretary, proposed me. We entered into our negotiations. I asked 50 louis as salary, which was little enough for a post in which it was necessary to keep up an appearance. He only offered 100 pistoles, and I was to pay my own travelling expenses. A louis was then worth 24 francs, a pistole 10. The proposal was ridiculous. We were unable to come to terms. Monsieur de Francois, who did his utmost to prevent me from going, in the end prevailed. I remained, and Monsieur de Montaigu departed, taking with him another secretary named Monsieur Follot, who had been recommended to him at the Foreign Office. No sooner had they arrived at Venice than they quarrelled. Follot, seeing that he had to do with a madman, left him in the lurch, and Monsieur de Montaigu, having no one but a young abbé named de Bigny, who wrote under the secretary's instruction, and was not in a position to fill the place, was obliged to have recourse to me again. The Chevalier, his brother, a man of intelligence, by giving me to understand that there were certain privileges connected with the post of secretary, succeeded in inducing me to accept the 1,000 francs. I received 20 louis for my travelling expenses, and set out. 1743 to 1744. At Lyon, I should have liked to take the route by way of Mont-Cenis, in order to pay a passing visit to my poor mamma, but I went down the Rhone and took ship at Geneva for Toulon, on account of the war and for the sake of economy, and also in order to procure a passport from Monsieur de Mirepoix, at that time commander in Provence, to whom I had been directed. Monsieur de Montaigu, finding himself unable to do without me, wrote me letter after letter to hasten my journey. An incident delayed it. It was the time of the plague at Messina. The English fleet was anchored there, and visited the felucca on which I was. On our arrival at Genoa, after a long and tedious passage, we were subjected to a quarantine of 21 days. The passengers were allowed the choice of performing it on board, or in the lazzaretto, where we were warned that we should find nothing but the 4 walls, since there had been no time to furnish it. All chose the felucca except myself. The insupportable heat, the confined space, the impossibility of taking exercise, and the vermin on board, made me prefer the lazzaretto at all hazards. I was conducted into a large 2-storied building, absolutely bare, in which I found neither windows, nor table, nor bed, nor chair, not even a stool to sit upon, nor a bundle of straw to lie on. They brought me my cloak, my travelling bag, and my two trunks. The heavy doors with huge locks were shut upon me, and I remained at liberty to walk as I pleased, from room to room and from story to story, finding everywhere the same solitude and the same bareness. In spite of all this, I did not regret having chosen the lazaretto in preference to the felucca, and, like a second Robinson Crusoe, I began to make the same arrangements for my 21 days as I should have done for my whole life. At first I had the amusement of hunting the lice, which I'd picked up in the felucca. When, after frequent changes of clothing and linen, I had at length succeeded in getting myself clean, I proceeded to furnish the room which I had chosen. I made myself a good mattress out of my waistcoats and shirts, some sheets out of a number of napkins which I sewed together, a blanket out of my dressing gown, a pillow out of my cloak rolled up. I made a seat of one of my trunks laid flat, and a table of the other set on end. I took out an inkstand and some paper, and arranged about a dozen books which I had by way of a library. In short, I made myself so comfortable that, with the exception of windows and curtains, I was almost as well lodged in this absolutely bare lazaretto as in my tennis court in the Rue Verdelet. My meals were served with much ceremony. Two grenadiers with fixed bayonets accompanied them. The staircase was my dining room. The landing did duty for a table, the bottom step for a seat. And as soon as my dinner was served, they retired, after having rung a bell, to inform me that I might sit down to table. Between my meals, when I was not reading, writing, or working at my furnishing, I went for a walk in the Protestant cemetery, which served me as a courtyard, or I ascended a turret, from which I could see the ships entering and leaving the harbour. In this manner I spent 14 days, and I could have spent the whole 21 there without a moment's weariness, had not Monsieur de Genville, the French ambassador, to whom I managed to send a letter saturated with vinegar, perfumed and half-burnt, procured me a remission of 8 days, which I spent at his house, where I confess I find myself more comfortably lodged than at the lazaretto. He treated me with very great kindness. Dupont, his secretary, was a good fellow, who introduced me to several houses, both in Genoa and in the country, where we were agreeably entertained. We became very good friends and kept up a correspondence for a long time afterwards. I had a pleasant journey through Lombardy. I visited Milan, Verona, Brescia, and Padua, and at length reached Venice, where the ambassador was impatiently expecting me. I found heaps of dispatches from the court and the other ambassadors, of which he had been unable to read the parts written in cipher, although he possessed the key. As I had never worked in any office, and had never in my life seen a government cipher, I was at first afraid of finding myself perplexed, but I found that nothing could be more simple, and in less than a week I had deciphered the whole, which certainly was not worth the trouble, for the embassy at Venice has seldom much to do. And besides, the government would not have cared to entrust the most trifling negotiation to a man like Monsieur de Montaigu. Until my arrival he had found himself in great difficulties, since he did not know how to dictate or to write legibly. I was very useful to him. He was aware of it and treated me well. He had another reason for this. After the departure of his predecessor, Monsieur de Franlay, who had gone out of his mind, the French consul, Monsieur Leblanc, had taken over the affairs of the embassy, and even after the arrival of Monsieur de Montaigu, continued to manage them until he had familiarized the latter with the routine. Monsieur de Montaigu, in his jealousy at the performance of his duties by another, although he himself was incapable of them, conceived an aversion to the consul, and as soon as I arrived, deprived him of the functions of ambassadorial secretary, in order to hand them over to me. These functions being inseparable from the title, he told me to assume it. As long as I remained with him, he never sent anyone, except myself, under this name to the Senate or persons sent by it to confer with him. That is, conférant, the dignitaries sent by the Senate of the Republic of Venice to confer with foreign ambassadors. And really, it was very natural that he should prefer to have, as ambassadorial secretary, a person attached to himself than a consul or office clerk appointed by the court. This made my situation tolerably agreeable, and prevented his noblemen, who, like his pages and most of his people, were Italians, from disputing precedence with me in the house. I successfully made use of the authority attached to it to maintain his droit de liste, that is to say, the freedom of his quarter, against the attempts which were several times made to infringe it, and which his Venetian officers were unwilling or unable to resist. But I never allowed banditti to take refuge there, although I might thereby have gained considerable profit, which his excellency would not have disdained to share. He even presumed to lay claim to part of the perquisites of the secretaryship, which were called the chancellerie. Although it was in time of war, a number of passports had to be made out. For each of these passports, a sequin was paid to the secretary who drew out and countersigned them. A sequin was worth from 9 to 12 francs. All my predecessors had been in the habit of demanding this sequin from Frenchmen and foreigners alike. This practice appeared to me unfair, and although I was not a Frenchman, I abolished it in the case of the French. But I exacted my perquisite so rigorously from everyone else that when the Marquis Scotti, the brother of the favourite of the Queen of Spain, had sent a messenger to me for a passport without my perquisite, I sent to ask him for it, a piece of audacity which the revengeful Italian did not forget. As soon as the reform which I had introduced in regard to the taxing of passports became known, nothing but crowds of pretended Frenchmen presented themselves in order to procure them, who, in a fearful jargon, called themselves Provençals, Picards, and Burgundians. As I have a tolerably keen ear, I was rarely taken in, and I do not believe that a single Italian ever did me out of my sequin, or that a single Frenchman paid it. I was foolish enough to tell Monsieur de Montaigu, who knew nothing about anything, of what I had done. The word sequin made him open his ears, and without expressing any opinion upon the suppression of the fees for the French, he demanded that I should settle with him on account of the others, promising me other equivalent advantages in return. Indignant at this meanness, rather than influenced by feelings of self-interest, I scornfully rejected his proposal. He persisted. I grew warm. "No, monsieur," I said to him in a decided tone, "let your excellency keep what belongs to you, and leave me what is mine. I will never give up a sou." When he saw that he could gain nothing by this means, he adopted another plan, and had the effrontery to say to me that since I drew the perquisites of his chancellerie, it was only fair that I should bear the expenses of it. I did not care to squabble about such a trifle, and from that time I provided my own ink, paper, sealing wax, candles, ribbon, and even the seal, which I had repaired, without receiving a farthing from him by way of reimbursement. This did not prevent me from making over a small share of the fees to the Abbé de Bigny, who was a good fellow, and never attempted to claim it. If he was civil to me, I was equally straightforward with him, and we always got on very well together. I found the performance of my duties less difficult than I had expected, seeing that I had no experience, and was associated with an ambassador who was equally inexperienced, whose ignorance and obstinacy, in addition, seemed to delight in thwarting everything that good sense and some little knowledge suggested to me as likely to be useful for the king's service and his own. His most sensible act was to form a connection with the Marquis de Marie, the Spanish ambassador, a clever and shrewd person, who could have led him by the nose if he had been so minded, but who, out of consideration for the common interests of the two courts, usually gave him good advice, which was rendered useless by Monsieur de Montaigu, who always intruded some of his own ideas when carrying it out. The only thing they had to do in common was to induce the Venetians to observe neutrality. The latter, who continually protested their faithful observance of it, nevertheless publicly supplied the Austrian troops with ammunition, and even with recruits, under the pretense that they were deserters. Monsieur de Montaigu, who I believe desired to gain the goodwill of the Republic, in spite of my representations, invariably made me give assurances in all his dispatches that there was no fear that the Venetians would ever violate the conditions of neutrality. The obstinacy and stupidity of this poor man made me every moment write and commit absurdities, of which I was obliged to be the agent since he so desired it, but which sometimes rendered the performance of my duties unendurable, and even almost impracticable. For instance, he insisted that most of his dispatches to the king and the minister should be written in cipher, although neither the one nor the other contained anything at all which rendered such a precaution necessary. I represented to him that between Friday, when the dispatches from the court arrived, and Saturday, when our own were sent off, there was not sufficient time for so much writing in cipher, and the large amount of correspondence which I had to get ready for the same courier. He discovered an admirable plan. This was to begin on Thursday to write the answers to the dispatches which were due on the following day. This idea appeared to him so happy that, in spite of all I could say to the impossibility and absurdity of carrying it out, I was obliged to resign myself to it. For the rest of the time that I remained with him, after having kept note of a few words uttered by him at random during the week, and of some trifling pieces of information which I picked up here and there, provided with these scanty materials, I never failed to bring him on Thursday morning the rough draft of the dispatches which had to be sent off on Saturday, with the exception of a few hurried additions or corrections, which were rendered necessary by the dispatches which arrived on Friday, to which ours were intended to be the reply. Another very amusing whim of his, which made his own correspondence indescribably ridiculous, was to send back each item of news to its source, instead of making it follow its course. He sent the news from the court to Monsieur Amelot, the news from Paris to Monsieur de Maurepas, the news from Sweden to Monsieur d'Avrincourt, the news from St. Petersburg to Monsieur de la Chetadie, and sometimes he sent back to each of these the news which came from him, after I had slightly altered it. As he only glanced through the dispatches to the court, out of all that I put before him to sign, and signed those to the other ambassadors without reading them, this gave me a little more liberty to revise the latter in my own way, and at least I made the information cross. But it was impossible for me to give a sensible turn to the important dispatches. I thought myself lucky when it did not occur to him to interlard them with some impromptu lines out of his own head, which obliged me to return, in order to transcribe, in all haste, the dispatch adorned with this new piece of imbecility, which was obliged to be honoured with the cipher, otherwise he would not have signed it. I was often tempted, out of regard for his reputation, to cipher something different from what he had dictated, but feeling that nothing could justify such a breach of good faith, I let him rave at his own risk, content with frankly expressing my opinion, and, at any rate, fulfilling my duty while I was in his service. This I always did with an honesty, a zeal, and a courage which deserved on his part a different reward from that which I received in the end. It was time that I should for once be what heaven, who had bestowed upon me a happy disposition, and what the education which I had received from the best women, and that which I had given myself, had intended me to be, and that I was then, left to myself without friends, without advisers, without experience, in a foreign land, in the service of a foreign nation, surrounded by a crowd of rascals who, for the sake of their own interest, and in order to remove the stumbling block of a good example, urged me to imitate them. In spite of all this, far from doing anything of the kind, I faithfully served France, to whom I owed nothing, and, as was only right, her ambassador even more faithfully in all that depended upon myself. Irreproachable in a position which was sufficiently open to observation, I deserved and obtained the esteem of the Republic, and of all the ambassadors with whom we corresponded, and the affection of all the French residents in Venice, not even excepting the consul, whom, to my regret, I supplanted in the performance of duties which I knew rightly belonged to him, and which brought me more trouble than pleasure. Monsieur de Montaigu, completely under the control of the Marquis Marie, who did not trouble himself about the details of his duty, neglected his own to such an extent that the French who lived in Venice would never have known that there was a French ambassador resident in the city, had it not been for me. Being always dismissed without a hearing, whenever they sought his protection, they became disgusted, and none of them were ever seen in his suite or at his table, to which, in fact, he never invited them. I frequently took it upon myself to do what he ought to have done. I did all I could for the French who applied to him or me. In any other country I would have done more, but as by reason of my official capacity I could not see anyone who held any position, I was frequently obliged to refer to the consul, who, being settled in the country with his family, was obliged to be careful, which prevented him from doing as much as he would have liked. Sometimes, however, when he hung back and did not venture to speak, I was emboldened to take dangerous steps, which generally proved successful. I remember one instance which even now makes me laugh. It would hardly be suspected that it is to me that the theatre-goers of Paris are indebted for Coraline and her sister Camille. But nothing is more true. Veronese, their father, had accepted an engagement for himself and his children in the Italian company, and after having received 2,000 francs for travelling expenses, instead of starting for France, quietly entered into an engagement at the Théâtre de Saint-Luc in Venice, where Coraline, although quite a child, attracted large audiences. Monsieur le Duc de Gèvres, as Lord High Chamberlain, wrote to the ambassador to claim the father and daughter. Monsieur de Montaigu handed me the letter and simply said, "See to this," without giving me any further instructions. I went to Monsieur Leblanc and begged him to speak to the patrician to whom the theatre belonged, who was, I believe, a Giustiniani, and persuaded him to dismiss Veronese as being engaged in the king's service. Leblanc, who was not very eager to accept the commission, performed it badly. Giustiniani had recourse to various subterfuges, and Veronese was not discharged. I felt annoyed. It was the time of the carnival. I took a domino and a mask and rode to the palace, Giustiniani. All who saw my gondola arrive with the ambassador's livery were astounded. Such a thing had never been seen in Venice. I entered and ordered myself to be announced as a lady in a mask. As soon as I was introduced, I removed my mask and announced myself. The senator turned pale and stood astounded. "Monsieur," I said to him in Venetian, "I regret to trouble Your Excellency with this visit, but you have at your theatre a man named Veronese, who is engaged in the king's service, who has been claimed from you, but without success. I come to demand him in His Majesty's name." This brief speech took effect. No sooner had I left than Giustiniani ran to give an account of the incident to the state inquisitors, who reprimanded him severely. Veronese was dismissed the same day. I sent him a message that if he did not start in a week I would have him arrested, and he set out without delay. On another occasion, by my own efforts, and almost without anyone's assistance, I extricated the captain of a merchant ship from a difficulty. He was a Marseillais named Olivet. I have forgotten the name of the ship. A quarrel had broken out between his crew and the Slavonians in the service of the Republic. Acts of violence had been committed, and the vessel had been placed under such strict embargo that no one, with the exception of the captain, was allowed to go on board or leave it without permission. He appealed to the ambassador, who told him to go to the devil. Next he applied to the consul, who told him that it was not a commercial matter, and that he could not interfere. At his wit's end he came to me. I represented to Monsieur de Montaigu that he ought to allow me to present a note on the subject to the Senate. I do not know whether he gave me permission, and whether I did so, but I well remember that, as my attempts proved ineffectual and the embargo was not removed, I resolved upon a course of action which proved successful. I inserted an account of the affair in a dispatch to Monsieur de Maurepas, although I had great difficulty in persuading Monsieur de Montaigu to allow it to stand. I knew that our dispatches, although they were hardly worth the trouble, were opened at Venice. I had proof of this, for I found passages from them reproduced word for word in the Gazette, a breach of faith of which I had vainly endeavoured to induce the ambassador to complain. My object, in speaking of this annoying circumstance in the dispatch, was to make use of the curiosity of the Venetians, in order to frighten them and induce them to release the vessel. For if it had been necessary to wait for an answer from the court upon the matter, the captain would have been ruined before it arrived. I did more. I went on board to question the crew. I took with me the Abbé Patizel, Chancellor of the Consulate, who only accompanied me with reluctance, for all these poor creatures were greatly afraid of offending the Senate. Being unable to go on board, on account of the prohibition, I remained in my gondola and drew up my report, interrogating all the crew in a loud voice, one after the other, and framing my questions in such a manner as to obtain replies which might be to their advantage. I wanted to induce Patizel to put the questions and draw up the report himself, which in fact was more his business than mine, but he refused. He never said a word and would scarcely consent to sign the report after me. However, this somewhat bold course proved successful, and the vessel was released long before the minister's answer arrived. The captain wanted to make me a present. Without showing any displeasure, I slapped him on the shoulder and said, "Capitaine Olivet, do you think that a man who does not demand from the French the fee for passports, which he finds established as a right, is likely to sell them the protection of the king?" He asked me, at least, to dine on board. I accepted the invitation and took with me Cario, the secretary to the Spanish embassy, an amiable and talented man, who has since held a similar position at Paris, as well as that of chargé d'affaires, and with whom I had formed an intimacy after the manner of our ambassadors. I should have been happy if, when I was doing all the good I was able to do with the most absolute disinterestedness, I had known how to introduce sufficient order and accuracy into all my trifling affairs, so as to avoid being taken in myself and serving others at my own expense. But in positions such as that which I held, in which the slightest mistakes are not without consequences, I exhausted all my attention in the effort not to commit any errors detrimental to my service. In all that concerned the essential duties of my office, I was to the last most regular and exact. With the exception of a few errors, which excessive haste caused me to make in ciphering, of which Monsieur Amelot's clerks once complained, neither the ambassador nor anyone else had ever to reproach me with carelessness in the performance of any of my duties, which was remarkable for a man so careless and thoughtless as I am. But I was sometimes forgetful and careless in the conduct of special commissions which I undertook, and my love of justice always made me take the blame upon myself of my own accord, before anyone thought of making a complaint. I will merely mention one instance, which has reference to my departure from Venice, and of which I subsequently felt the effects in Paris. Our cook, named Rousselot, had brought from France an old 200-franc bill, which a wig-maker of his acquaintance had received from a Venetian noble, Zanetto Nani, in payment for some wigs supplied. Rousselot brought this bill to me, and begged me to see whether anything could be made out of it by arrangement. I knew, and he knew also, that it is the regular practice of Venetian nobles never to pay debts contracted in a foreign country when once they have returned home. If any attempt is made to compel them to do so, they wear out the unhappy creditor with so many delays, and put him to such expense, that he becomes disheartened and finally abandons his claim altogether, or accepts the most trifling composition. I asked Monsieur Leblanc to speak to Zanetto, who acknowledged the bill but refused to pay. After a long struggle, he promised to pay 3 sequins. When Leblanc took him the bill, the 3 sequins were not ready, and there was nothing for it but to wait. During the interval occurred my quarrel with Monsieur de Montaigu, and my retirement from his service. I left the ambassador's papers in perfect order, but Rousselot's bill could not be found. Monsieur Leblanc assured me that he had returned it to me. I knew his honourable character too well to doubt his word, but I was utterly unable to recall to mind what had become of the bill. As Zanetto had acknowledged the debt, I begged Leblanc to try and get the 3 sequins by giving him a receipt, or to induce him to renew the bill in duplicate. But Zanetto, when he knew that the bill was lost, refused to do either. I offered the 3 sequins to Rousselot out of my own pocket, in order to discharge the bill. He refused to take them, and told me to arrange the matter with the creditor in Paris, whose address he gave me. But the wig-maker, who knew what had happened, demanded his bill or payment in full. In my indignation, what would I not have given to find the accursed bill? I paid the 200 francs myself, and that at a time when I was greatly pressed for money. Thus, the loss of the bill procured for the creditor payment of the debt in full, whereas if, unfortunately for him, it had been found, he would have experienced a difficulty in getting the 10 crowns promised by His Excellency Zanetto Nanni. The capacity for my employment, which I believe I possessed, made my work agreeable, and with the exception of the society of my friend Cario and the excellent Altuna, of whom I shall speak presently, the very innocent recreations of the theatre and the Piazza di San Marco, and a few visits which we nearly always paid together, I found my only pleasure in the performance of my duties. Although my work was not very laborious, especially as I had the assistance of the Abbé de Bini, I was always tolerably busy, since our correspondence was very extensive, and war was going on. Every day I worked for the greater part of the morning, and on post-days sometimes until midnight. I devoted the remainder of my time to the study of the profession which I was entering upon, and in which I hoped, in consequence of my successful début, to be appointed to a more lucrative post. In fact, there was only one opinion concerning me, beginning with that of the ambassador, who was thoroughly satisfied with my services, and never made a single complaint. His subsequent rage arose from the fact that, finding that my complaints were not listened to, I demanded my discharge. The ambassadors and ministers of the king, with whom we were in correspondence, paid him compliments upon the efficiency of his secretary, which ought to have been flattering to him, but which produced quite the contrary effect in his perverse head. One compliment in particular, which he received on a special occasion, he never forgave me. The circumstances deserve explanation. He was so little capable of imposing any constraint upon himself that even on Saturday, the day on which nearly all the couriers left, he could not wait till the work was finished before going out. And, incessantly urging me to finish the dispatches for the king and the ministers, he hurriedly signed them and ran off, I know not whither, generally leaving the rest of the letters unsigned. This obliged me, when there was nothing but news, to throw them into the form of a bulletin. But when it was a question of affairs relating to the service of the king, someone was obliged to sign them, and I did so. I did this in the case of an important dispatch, which we had just received from Monsieur Vincent, the king's chargé d'affaires, at Vienna. This was at the time when the Prince de Lobkowitz was marching to Naples, and the Comte de Gages carried out that memorable retreat, the finest military achievement of the century, which attracted too little attention in Europe. The information that reached us was that a man, of whom Monsieur Vincent sent us the description, was setting out from Vienna with the intention of secretly passing by way of Venice to the Abruzzi, in order to bring about a rising of the people in that quarter, on the approach of the Austrians. In the absence of Monsieur de Montaigu, who took no interest in anything, I sent on to Monsieur le Marquis de l'Hôpital this information, which was so opportune, that is, perhaps to the much-abused Jean-Jacques, that the House of Bourbon owes the preservation of the Kingdom of Naples. The Marquis de l'Hôpital, as was proper, thanked his colleague and spoke to him about his secretary and the service which he had just rendered to the common cause. The Comte de Montaigu, who had to reproach himself with carelessness in the matter, thought that he saw in this a reproof intended for himself, and spoke to me somewhat angrily about it. I had had occasion to do the same for the Comte de Castellan, ambassador at Constantinople, although in a less important matter. As there was no other communication with Constantinople except the couriers sent by the Senate, from time to time, to its Baile, notice of the departure of these couriers was given to the French ambassador, in order that he might take the opportunity of writing to his colleague, if he thought fit. A Baile was the title of the Venetian ambassador at Constantinople. This notice was usually given a day or two beforehand, but so little was thought of Monsieur de Montaigu that it was considered sufficient to send to him an hour or two before the courier's departure, merely for form's sake. So that I frequently had to write the dispatch in his absence. Monsieur de Castellan, in replying, made honourable mention of me. Monsieur de Genville, at Genoa, did the same. And each token of their good opinion of me became a fresh cause for grievance. I confess that I did not try to avoid the opportunity of making myself known, but neither did I seek it unbecomingly. It appeared to me only fair that I should look for the natural reward of valuable services, that is to say, the esteem of those who are in a position to estimate and reward them. I do not know whether my assiduity in the fulfilment of my duties afforded the ambassador a legitimate reason for complaint, but I certainly know that it was the only complaint that he uttered up to the day of our separation. His house, which he had never put upon a proper footing, was always full of rabble. The French were badly treated, the Italians had the upper hand, and even amongst them, those good servants who had long been attached to the embassy were all rudely discharged. Amongst them, his first gentleman, who had already held the position with the Comte de Franley, whose name, I believe, was the Comte Peati, or something very like it. The second gentleman, whom he had chosen himself, was a bandit from Mantua, by name Domenico Vitali, whom the ambassador entrusted with the care of his house, and who, by dint of toadying and sordid stinginess, gained his confidence and became his favourite, to the detriment of the few honest persons who were still around him, and of the secretary who was at their head. The honest eye of an upright man always makes rogues uneasy. This alone would have been enough to make him hate me, but there was yet another reason for his hatred, which aggravated it considerably. I must state what this reason was, and I am willing to be condemned if I was wrong. According to long-established custom, the ambassador had a box at each of the five theatres. Every day at dinner he named the theatre to which he intended to go. I had the next choice, and his gentlemen disposed of the other boxes between them. As I went out, I took the key of the box which I had chosen. One day, as Vitali was not there, I commissioned the lackey who attended upon me to bring me my key to a house which I named to him. Vitali, instead of sending me the key, said that he had disposed of it. I was the more incensed, as the footman gave me an account of his errand before everybody. In the evening, Vitali tried to utter a few words of apology, to which I refused to listen. "Sir," said I to him, "you will come tomorrow at a stated time to the house in which I received the insult, and will make your apologies to me in the presence of those who witnessed it. Otherwise, the day after tomorrow, whatever happens, I declare that either you or I will leave this house." My resolute tone inspired him with respect. He came to the house at the appointed time, and apologized publicly, in an abject manner worthy of him. But he laid his plans at leisure, and while cringing to me in public, in secret he worked so successfully in true Italian fashion that, although he could not persuade the ambassador to dismiss me, he obliged me to resign my position myself. Such a wretch was certainly not capable of understanding me, but he knew enough of me to serve his own ends. He knew that I was good-natured and mild to excess in enduring involuntary injustice, proud and hasty when insulted with malice aforethought, a lover of decency and dignity on proper occasions, and no less exacting in the respect that was due to me than careful in showing to others the respect that I owed to them. He resolved to take advantage of this to disgust me, and succeeded. He turned the house upside down and banished from it the regularity, subordination, order, and decency which I had endeavoured to maintain there. An establishment without a woman at its head requires a somewhat severe discipline in order to introduce the rule of decency which is inseparable from dignity. He soon made ours a house of dissoluteness and debauchery, a haunt of rogues and profligates. Having procured the dismissal of the second gentleman, he bestowed his place upon another pimp like himself, who kept a public brothel at the Maltese Cross. And these two rascals, who understood each other perfectly, were as shameless as they were insolent. With the exception of the ambassador's room, and even that was not in very good order, there was not a corner in the house endurable for a respectable man. As His Excellency did not take supper, the gentleman and myself had a special meal, of which the Abbé de Bigny and the pages also partook. In the commonest beer shop one would have been served with more cleanliness and decency, and provided with cleaner table linen and better food. We had nothing but one small, dirty tallow candle, pewter plates, and iron forks. I might have endured what went on in private, but I was deprived of my gondola. Of all the ambassadorial secretaries, I was the only one who was obliged to hire one or to go on foot. And I was only attended by His Excellency's servants when I went to the Senate. Besides, all that went on in the house was known in the city. All the ambassador's officials cried out loudly. Domenico, who was the sole cause of all, cried the loudest, since he knew well that the indecent manner in which we were treated affected me more than all the rest. I was the only person in the house who said nothing outside, but I complained loudly to the ambassador, not only of what went on, but also of himself. And he, being secretly urged on by his evil genius, daily put some new affront upon me. Being obliged to spend a considerable sum in order to keep on a level with my colleagues, and to live in a manner befitting my position, I could not save a sou out of my salary, and when I asked him for money, he talked to me of his esteem and of his confidence in me, as if that ought to have been enough to fill my purse and provide for all my wants. These two bandits at length succeeded in completely turning their master's head, which was already weak enough. They ruined him by continual dealings in old curiosities, and induced him to conclude bargains, in which he was always taken in, but which they persuaded him were marvels of sharpness. They made him rent a palace on the Brenta for twice as much as it was worth, and shared the surplus with the proprietor. The rooms were inlaid with mosaic and adorned with pillars and columns of beautiful marble, after the fashion of the country. Monsieur de Montaigu had all this covered with a magnificent fur panelling, for the simple reason that the rooms in Paris are wainscoted in this manner. For a similar reason, he was the only ambassador in Venice who deprived his pages of their swords and his footmen of their sticks. Such was the man who, perhaps for the same reason, took a dislike to me solely because I served him faithfully. I patiently endured his neglect, his brutality, and ill-treatment as long as I thought I saw in it only bad temper and no signs of hatred. But as soon as I saw that the design had been formed of depriving me of the consideration I deserved for my faithful services, I determined to resign my post. The first proof of his ill-will which I received was on the occasion of a dinner, which he intended to give to the Duke of Modena and his family, who were at Venice, at which he informed me that I could not be present. I answered with some annoyance, but without anger, that as I had the honour of dining there every day, if the Duke of Modena, when he arrived, required that I should not be present, it would be a point of honour for His Excellency and a duty for me not to yield to his request. "What," said he, in a rage, "does my secretary, who is not even a gentleman, claim to dine with a sovereign, when my gentlemen do not?" "Yes, sir," I replied, The post with which Your Excellency has honoured me confers such high rank upon me, as long as I hold it, that I even take precedence of your gentlemen, or those who call themselves such, and I am admitted where they cannot appear. You are aware that on the day when you make your public entry, I am required by etiquette and immemorial custom to follow you in state robes, and have the honour of dining with you in the palace of St. Mark. And I do not see why a man, who is allowed and required to dine in public with the Doge and Senate of Venice, should not be allowed to dine in private with the Duke of Modena. Although my argument was unanswerable, the ambassador would not give in, but we had no occasion to renew the dispute, for the Duke of Modena did not come to dinner. From that time he never ceased to cause me annoyance, and to treat me with injustice, by doing his utmost to deprive me of the trifling privileges attached to my post, in order to hand them over to his dear Vitali. And I am sure that if he had dared to send him to the Senate in my place, he would have done so. He usually employed the Abbe de Bini to write his private letters in his study. He commissioned him to write an account of the affair of Capitaine Olivet to Monsieur de Maurepas, in which, without making any mention of me, who alone had interfered in the matter, he even deprived me of the honour of the report, of which he sent him a duplicate, and gave the credit of it to Pazizel, who had not said a single word. He wanted to annoy me and please his favourite, without, however, getting rid of me. He felt that it would not be so easy to find a successor to me as to Monsieur Foulot, who had already spread abroad what kind of a man he was. A secretary who knew Italian was absolutely necessary to him, on account of the answers from the Senate. One who was able to write all his dispatches and manage all his affairs without his interference. Who combined with the merit of serving him faithfully the meanness of playing the agreeable to his contemptible gentlemen. He accordingly desired to keep me and mortify me at the same time, by keeping me far from my country and his own, without money to return. And he would perhaps have succeeded if he had set about it more prudently. But Vitali, who had other views, and wanted to force me to make up my mind, succeeded. As soon as I saw that I was wasting my trouble, that the ambassador regarded my services as crimes, instead of being grateful to me for them, that I had nothing more to look for, as long as I was with him, but annoyance in the house and injustice outside, and that, amidst the general discredit which he had brought upon himself, the harm he attempted to do me might injure me more than his good offices could benefit me, I made up my mind and asked permission to resign, giving him time, however, to provide himself with another secretary. Without saying yes or no, he continued to behave as before. Seeing that matters did not improve, and that he took no steps to find another secretary, I wrote to his brother, and telling him my reasons, begged him to obtain my dismissal from His Excellency, adding that, in any case, it was impossible for me to remain. I waited for some time, but received no answer. I was beginning to feel greatly embarrassed when the ambassador at length received a letter from his brother. It must have been very outspoken, for, although he was subject to most violent outbreaks of rage, I never saw him so furious before. After a torrent of horrible abuse, not knowing what else to say, he accused me of having sold the key of his cipher. I began to laugh, and asked him, scoffingly, if he thought that there was in all Venice a man who would be fool enough to give him a crown for it. This answer made him foam with rage. He made a pretense of calling his servants, as he said, to throw me out of the window. Until then I had been very quiet, but at this threat anger and indignation got the mastery of me in my turn. I rushed to the door, and having drawn the bolt which fastened it inside, I gravely went up to him and said, "No, Monsieur le Comte, your people shall not interfere in this matter. Be good enough to allow it to be settled between ourselves." This action on my part and my demeanour calmed him at once. His whole attitude betrayed surprise and alarm. When I saw that he'd recovered from his frenzy, I bade him adieu in a few words, and then, without waiting for him to answer, I opened the door, left the room, and walked quietly through the anteroom in the midst of his people, who rose as usual, and who, I rarely believe, would rather have assisted me against him than him against me. Without going up to my room again, I immediately went downstairs and left the palace, never to enter it again. I went straight to Monsieur Leblanc to tell him what had taken place. He was not much surprised. He knew the man. He kept me to dinner. The dinner, though impromptu, was splendid. All the French in Venice who are of any importance were present. There was not a single person at the ambassador's. The consul related my case to the company. At the recital, all cried out with one voice, but not in favour of His Excellency. He had not settled my account, and had not given me a sou, and, reduced to a few louis which I had in my purse, I did not know how I was to pay the expenses of my return. Everyone offered me the use of his purse. I borrowed 20 sequins from Monsieur Leblanc, and the same amount from Monsieur de Saint-Cyr, with whom, next after him, I was most intimate. I thanked the others, and, until I left, I lodged with the Chancellor of the Consulate, in order to prove to the public that the nation had no share in the unjust behaviour of the ambassador. The latter, enraged at seeing me fêted in my misfortune, while he, in spite of being an ambassador, was neglected, lost his head altogether and behaved like a madman. He so far forgot himself as to present a written memorial to the Senate, demanding my arrest. The Abbé de Bigny having given me a hint of this, I decided to remain another fortnight, instead of leaving on the second day as I had intended. My conduct had been seen and approved. I was universally esteemed. The Seigneurie did not even condescend to reply to the ambassador's extravagant memorial, and informed me, through the consul, that I could remain in Venice as long as I pleased, without troubling myself about the vagaries of a madman. I continued to visit my friends. I went to take leave of the Spanish ambassador, who received me very kindly, and of the Comte de Finocchietti, the Neapolitan minister, whom I did not find at home. I wrote to him, however, and received a most courteous reply from him. At last I set out, and in spite of my difficulties I left no other debts than the loans of which I have just spoken, and about 50 crowns which I owed to a merchant named Morandi, which Cario undertook to pay, and which I have never returned to him, although we have often seen each other since then. As for the 2 loans, I punctually repaid them as soon as it was in my power to do so. I must not leave Venice without saying a few words about the famous amusements of this city, or at least the small share of them which I enjoyed during my stay. The reader has seen how little I sought after the pleasures of youth, or at least those which are so called. My tastes underwent no alteration at Venice, but my occupations, which would have prevented me from seeking them, gave a greater relish to the simple pleasures which I allowed myself. Foremost and most delightful of these was the company of persons of distinction, such as Messieurs Leblanc, de Saint-Cyr, Cario, Altuna, and a Forlan gentleman whose name, to my great regret, I have forgotten, and whose amiability I cannot recall without emotion. Forlan is from the country of Frioul, part of which is now included in the Austrian states, and part in the Kingdom of Italy. It has given name to a dance, Forlane. Of all the men whose acquaintance I have ever made, he was the one whose heart most resembled my own. We had also become intimate with 2 or 3 witty and well-educated Englishmen, who were as passionately fond of music as ourselves. All these gentlemen had their wives or female friends or mistresses. The latter were nearly all women of education, at whose houses music and dancing took place. A little gambling also went on, but our lively tastes, talents, and fondness for the theatre rendered this amusement insipid. Gambling is only the resource of those who do not know what to do with themselves. I had brought with me from Paris the national prejudice against Italian music, but nature had also endowed me with that fine feeling against which such prejudices are powerless. I soon conceived for this music the passion which it inspires in those who are capable of judging it correctly. When I heard the barcaroles, the gondoliers' songs, I discovered that I'd never heard singing before, and I soon became so infatuated with the opera that, tired of chattering, eating, and playing in the boxes, when I only wanted to listen, I often stole away from the company in order to find another seat, where, quite alone, shut up in my box, in spite of the length of the performance, I abandoned myself to the pleasure of enjoying it, without being disturbed, until it was over. One day, at the theatre of San Cristoson, I fell asleep more soundly than I could have done in my bed. The noisy and brilliant airs failed to wake me. But it would be impossible to describe the delightful sensation produced upon me by the sweet harmony and angelic music of the air which finally aroused me. What an awakening! What rapture! What ecstasy when I opened, at the same moment, my eyes and my ears! My first idea was to believe myself in paradise. This delightful piece, which I still recollect, and which I shall never forget while I live, began as follows. Conservami la bella, che si m'ascende il cor. I wanted to have the music. I procured it and kept it for a long time, but it was not the same on paper as in my memory. The notes were certainly the same, but it was not the same thing. This divine air can only be performed in my head, as it was rarely performed at the time when it awoke me. The music, which according to my taste is far superior to that of the opera, and which has not its like, either in Italy or the rest of the world, is that of the scuole. The scuole are charitable institutions, founded for the education of young girls without means, who are subsequently portioned by the Republic either for marriage or for the cloister. Amongst the accomplishments cultivated in these young girls, music holds the first place. Every Sunday, in the church of each of these scuole, during Vespers, motets are performed with full chorus and full orchestra, composed and conducted by the most famous Italian masters, executed in the latticed galleries by young girls only, all under 20 years of age. I cannot imagine anything so voluptuous, so touching, as this music. The abundant art, the exquisite taste of the singing, the beauty of the voices, the correctness of the execution. Everything in these delightful concerts contributes to produce an impression which is certainly not good style, but against which I doubt whether any man's heart is proof. Cario and myself never missed going to Vespers in the Mendicanti, and we were not the only ones. The church was always full of amateurs. Even operatic singers came to form their taste after these excellent models. What drove me to despair was the confounded gratings, which only allowed the sounds to pass through, and hid from sight the angels of beauty, of whom they were worthy. I could talk of nothing else. While speaking about it one day, at Monsieur Leblanc's, he said, "If you are so curious to see these young girls, it is easy to satisfy you. I am one of the directors of the institution. I will take you to a collation with them." That is to say, a goûter, a light meal between dinner and supper. I did not give him a moment's peace until he kept his word. When we entered the salon which confined these longed-for beauties, I felt an amorous trembling, which I had never before experienced. Monsieur Leblanc presented these famous singers to me one after the other, whose names and voices were all that I knew about them. "Come, Sophie." She was a horrible fright. "Come, Katina." She had only one eye. "Come, Bettina." She was disfigured by smallpox. Hardly one of them was without some noticeable defect. The cruel wretch laughed at my painful surprise. Two or three, however, appeared passable. They only sang in the chorus. I was in despair. During the collation we teased them, and they became quite lively. Ugliness does not exclude certain graces which I found they possessed. I said to myself, they could not sing so delightfully without soul. They must possess one. At last the feeling with which I regarded them was so altered that I left the room almost in love with all these ugly creatures. I hardly ventured to return to their vespers. I had reason to feel that the danger was over. I continued to find their singing delicious, and their voices lent such a fictitious charm to their faces that, as long as they were singing, I persisted in thinking them beautiful, in spite of my eyes. Music in Italy costs so little that it is not worth while for anyone who is fond of it to deprive himself of it. I hired a piano, and for a crown I engaged 4 or 5 symphonists to come to my rooms, with whom, once a week, I practised the pieces which had afforded me most pleasure at the opera. I also made them try some symphonies from my Muse Galante. Either because they really pleased, or because he wanted to flatter me, the ballet master of Saint-Jean Chrysostom asked me for 2 of them, which I had the pleasure of hearing performed by this admirable orchestra. They were danced by a little Bettina, a pretty and amiable girl, who was kept by one of our friends, a Spaniard named Fagoaga, at whose house we often spent the evening. As for women, it is not in a city like Venice that a man abstains from them. Have you no confessions to make on this point? Someone may ask. Yes, I have something to